From Hollywood, this brings you the voice of America's foremost teller of tales, John Nesbitt. How do you do, everyone, for today's chapter in the 1949 edition of our Passing Parade. And after the announcer's introduction, we'll transcribe a whole hatful of notes and anecdotes for our current series about the men and women who changed the world forever as they marched in time's passing parade.
There's an old saying to the effect that you only get out of life what you put into it. But that's not true when it comes to United States savings bonds, because every $3 you invest today in savings bonds, you'll get back four in only 10 short years. That's wonderful interest on a wonderful investment. Now, during the 1949 Opportunity Drive, start building a secure future for yourself and your family. Start that college fund for your children. Make sure that tomorrow is brighter than today. Sign up for one of the easy automatic plans for buying savings bonds, the payroll savings plan where you work, or if you are your own boss, the bond a month plan where you bank. Either way, provide your opportunity for financial security. So invest in United States savings bonds. Now here is John Nesbitt.
Watching the procession move by again, as we consider this group of stories about people who changed the world, we might, of course, keep right on with such a subject for the next 22 and a half years. Because, of course, every man and woman of us, to some extent, alters the world forever for those who come after. Every time we vote for president, for example, we are each of us affecting the destiny of descendants who will come after us 1,000 years after we are dead and forgotten. And if you ran that idea right down to its last possibility, you would have to admit that each of us never goes to bed at the close of any day without having done something that will find a place in the future. For the future is a very big place. To begin with a very trivial and foolish example, consider the fact that on July the 23rd in 1851, a rather rattle-brained female named Mrs. Amelia Bloomer got out of her carriage at Lowell, Massachusetts, and rocked the world back on its heels. Mrs. Bloomer was a woman with a tidy private income and nothing much to occupy her. She found a cause to fill her life, however, when she became upset about the long and trailing skirts which women wore in her day. She decided that for a lady to have so many yards of cloth dragging along behind her that she stirred up a small dust storm every time she crossed the street was a most evil state of affairs. So Mrs. Bloomer, on July the 23rd, was prepared. She climbed down from her carriage, she crossed the sidewalk, and she rang the doorbell of a large and fashionable mansion where she had been invited to tea. When the butler opened the door for Mrs. Bloomer, he turned purple in the face. And when her hostess came sweeping up to greet Mrs. Bloomer, she turned dead white in the face. For Mrs. Bloomer was wearing a get-up that would shock a Zulu. She was wearing a short skirt, which came about halfway between her knee and ankle, as women's skirts seem to be doing right now. But because she did not have enough courage to show the shape of her legs below the skirt, she had installed under it a prodigious bulgy pair of trousers, ballooning out about a foot wide and then gathered modestly tight around her ankles. Although she was wearing at least 12 yards of material, this outfit of Mrs. Bloomer's was not only considered crazy, but illegal, indecent, and immoral. She was asked to leave the party, which she did. And within 24 hours, her costume was a headline sensation. Ministers based sermons upon it, all being opposed violently, by the way. Local ordinances were passed, making it a jail offense to be seen in a rig like it. And in general, both men and their wives greeted the whole idea with a shout of rage. The garment which she had invented was called, of course, Bloomer's, and as such is titled to this day. For 75 years, Mrs. Bloomer's invention had no effect whatsoever upon women's styles, which remained in the field of total idiocy. Only then did girls, wishing more freedom of physical movement, begin chopping at the hems of their skirts, and then out of modesty, they had, of course, to make use of a pair of Mrs. Bloomer's creation. But to get back to our theme, how could such a small matter possibly be described as one that changed the world? At the time that Mrs. Bloomer kicked over the apple cart of proper social behavior, women in America had reached a point of slavery to men and to their own customs, which was more complete than it had ever been before in our history or since. Not only had middle-class women become enslaved, but they had accepted the idea completely and defended it cheerfully. Many a delicate lady was proud of being stupid, proud of being weak, and most mothers carefully taught their daughters that all serious mental responsibility was to be left to the men, and complete obedience to one's husband was the only way to happiness. It is one of the supreme tragedies of humanity that far more often than they have fought for freedom, slaves of every kind, political slaves or economic slaves, have kissed their chains and said, slavery like this is the only respectable way to live. So Mrs. Bloomer, merely by dressing as she personally saw fit, demonstrated the astounding theory that a woman might have a mind of her own. While virtually no other woman found courage to follow her example, Mrs. Bloomer was remembered through the generations as a gal with the courage to defy the men. When the great women's suffrage movements began, it was Mrs. Bloomer who was one of the patron saints, a symbol of independence, and in her period she was almost the first of the great fighters. The idea grew until it was a national riot. Millions of women at last were defying the convention that childbearing and housework were a woman's sole privileges, until at last they won the vote in 1920. A world-changing movement has to begin somewhere. In this case, one of its major opening battles began when Mrs. Amelia Bloomer sailed in through the front door of a mansion and said, "How do you like it, girls? A little thing that I whipped up myself." This seems a good place to break for the announcer, after which we're going to examine another apparently minor incident, which is beyond question one of the titanic world-changing events of all time in the passing parade.
He is a writer, and one day an acquaintance asked this writer what was the greatest writing ever produced in this country. He named the set of laws upon which all other laws in this country rest, the Constitution of the United States, with its amendments, especially the Bill of Rights. Nothing else has ever been written in this country that guarantees so much to so many, he said. And isn't that a good test of great writing? Yes, look at it this way. The law guarantees freedom of speech, press, worship, and assembly. But it also urges and inspires you to speak and write the truth, to worship with a full and humble heart, and to assemble for the good of all people. I can't see how anyone can think of the law as something that fences you in, the writer said. Rather, it is the one thing that can keep you free. So the law is my friend and yours, and I am the law's friend, as I hope you are. For as I see it, freedom is everybody's job. Now, once again, to John Nesbitt.
On the reviewing stand once more, to follow the trail of very small happenings which changed the world, probably the outstanding example of history took place 41 years before the birth of Christ, when a Roman ambassador looked a moment too long into the eyes of a middle-aged Egyptian woman known as Cleopatra. According to the ancient records, Queen Cleopatra, when she heard that the mighty Mark Antony himself was coming to take over Egypt for the Roman Empire, decided that while there was no stopping Rome, she could at least put the matter on a personal basis. Mark Antony, you see, was a trained and tough diplomat soldier. He was working in the toughest, most professional foreign service that this earth has ever known. When he went to Egypt to organize that country as a puppet state for Rome, he was in the same position that such a man as Molotov is if he is sent out by the Kremlin to fulfill a mission. He follows instructions to the letter, as probably his life hinges upon his making no mistakes. Mark Antony had been warned by the Secret Service of Rome about this Cleopatra. He knew that she'd been married many times. He knew that she had had many children, and he knew that she was one of the cleverest women in the world. And yet, when this broken and smashed ruler, Cleopatra, came to meet the Roman conqueror, she came as a woman. She rode a magnificent barge down the Nile, a barge loaded with musicians and dancers, and she turned a bitter capitulation into a celebration of welcome. So the meeting between Cleopatra and Mark Antony must go down as an incident that changed the world forever. For within a matter of weeks, this great professional soldier and diplomat was ready to betray his own headquarters. He was chained in what they say is the maddest of all entanglements, which is a middle-aged love affair. Think of this. Both of these people already had grown children, grandchildren. Cleopatra was dark-skinned, she was fat and wrinkled. Mark Antony was gray and growing stiff with age. Before coming to Egypt, he had reached a point in his career where he was the emperor of one-third of the Roman Empire, which is to say he was one-third stockholder in the entire civilized world. Yet when headquarters got around to straightening out the failure of his mission in Egypt and sent a navy to take over, the man who was owner of a third of the world was there to fight against Rome for his sweetheart's Egypt. He was smashed, he committed suicide, Cleopatra followed him into death. Now, because Antony failed on this mission, the immense empire of Rome reached a point of chaos. So a strong, single dictator had to take over. Republican government became a myth. Earth's greatest civilization was ruled for more than a generation by this one man. He was the first of the absolute Roman emperors. And although a wise and brilliant man, that long rule of his smashed the tradition of voting and people's representation. Rome thereafter fell into the hands of the corrupt and insane emperors like Nero. It was rescued for 90 years by a string of good emperors and then sank into the long rottenness and decay that killed her. So the wonder of the ages, the mightiest of empires, turned into a one-man show and tumbled to disaster when the one-man system failed her, as it always will. Because in the crucial hour, weary Mark Antony met a middle-aged woman in Egypt on the banks of the Nile. The magic of Cleopatra is an unsolved mystery to this hour. Her power over Antony couldn't have been physical beauty, not merely because she was many years past her prime, but because Antony could have had a harem of 100 picked beauty winners at any moment that he chose to issue the request. I suspect that Cleopatra's gift was the power of friendship. This fabulously powerful man was lonely and sought a comrade, and that, I think, is what utterly changed the world. But now take a jump through the centuries with us to a moment when so trivial and ridiculous a thing as a few buzzing houseflies turned the trick that turned the ways of the world. The American Declaration of Independence is the document which, as we all know, gave birth to a really new world. The United States is its child. And yet, many long days after Jefferson toiled to put it down on paper, and a full month after John Hancock put that huge signature of his on the document, the balance of the men who were to add their names to it were still nervous or uncertain about signing it. As men will, they argued ceaselessly over every sentence, every word and semicolon. Some were in favor of making it more conservative and polite, in other words, playing it safe, and others insisted that it be a screaming declaration of war. On the 2nd of August, 1776, a full month after it had been written, they were still haggling over it and refusing to set down their names. And now, according to no less an authority than Thomas Jefferson himself, the summer day got hotter and hotter until the patriots were almost too exhausted to argue. And then in through the windows, which had to be opened to let in some fresh air, came a swarm of flies from a livery stable nearby. The flies buzzed through the room, they lighted on the legs of the representatives, and they began to sting. And men in those days, you'll remember, wore fine silk stockings and knee-length trousers. After a few minutes, the delegates were frantic with the desire to get out of the room, and with a sudden, impatient rush, they stamped up and they signed the Declaration of Independence. Unless the afternoon had been so hot, and unless the flies had therefore swarmed through the open windows, that whole immense discussion might have bogged down in lawyers' hair-splitting and tricky debate. But because of a cloud of hungry flies, the nation, which now stands as the chief hope of free mankind, was hurried into being. In that sense, therefore, a swarm of flies must join the rest of our marchers in the company of those who forever changed the world. Our time's up. Here's the announcer before a brief note on the next edition.
Mutual is America's Sunday suit, and here are 9 reasons why Mutual suits everyone on Sunday. There's a wise and witty juvenile jury, the superstition debunking house of mystery, tales of true police detection on True Detective Mysteries, super suspense with the all-knowing shadow, electrifying entertainment with the dramatized quiz quick as a flash, western music, an adventure with the Roy Rogers Show, action mystery with Nick Carter, a comedy drama with Lionel Barrymore as mayor of the town, and your favorite music with Johnny Desmond. So for all radio, all-time Sunday favorites that suit you, suit me, suit everyone, tune to most of these stations on Sunday. And remember, regardless of daylight saving time, you'll hear all your favorite Sunday shows at the usual time on Mutual. For slow time, fast time, it's time to tune to Mutual. Now, a final word from John Nesbitt.
When we meet again, we'll begin a new series of great adventure yarns. Until then, this is John Nesbitt transcribing from California. A goodbye to you all.
Tune in tomorrow when Mutual will again present the voice of America's foremost teller of tales, John Nesbitt. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.